fine.
Well, thank you all for staying until the late afternoon, and thanks, of course, to all the organizers for this lovely program and conference and the opportunity to exchange so many ideas here. So my topic is pre-thermalization of weak intake and quantum systems. Actually, I'll be talking about a bit more than that, also about thermalization. This is a collaboration with these people, Alexander Wolf, Martin Eckstein, and Philipp Werner, and was done in part at the University of Augsburg. So this is my overview, and I try to keep this with a lot of maybe, so you don't all have to protest that this doesn't fit your definition of thermalization and so on. So a picture that you can have of relaxation in isolated quantum many-body systems is that, as we all know, in integral systems, they are the constants of motion. They usually prohibit the system from thermalization. And the non-thermal state that you get at long times may be describable by a generalized Gibbs ensemble. As we've heard already in some talks, if you are away from this really purely integrable point, but close to it, pre-thermalization can occur, and that is due to the vicinity of this integral situation. And then this will happen on intermediate time scales, and at later time scales, then possibly or usually thermalization can occur. And if you are considering the time evolution for a system that is really non-integrable, not in this vicinity, then you don't have to have this intermediate time scale. You can go sort of and thermalize directly, of course, but this is usually pretty hard to see numerically. And of course, the details, just as a caveat, they can will depend on the details, on the parameters of the Hamiltonian, the phases that you are maybe going in between, the initial states, and the observables that you actually look at. And I want to point to some details of the scenario, but let me first show you for what kind of model, because this is actually maybe not your favorite model, because it's the Hubbard model for fermions, not an Ising model. So this is really fermions on a lattice hopping. They get the letter V here because T is already taken for time. But it means really you have some band structure, maybe some tight binding band in any dimensions. We'll look at one and also higher dimensions. And the Hubbard interaction just penalizes, as you know, the double occupation that can occur. And as is well known, in general, depends also on the details, you can get a Mott metal insulator transition if U is on the order of the bandwidth. And of course, an important concept for high dimensional Hubbard models is Fermi-Liquid theory for not too large interactions. As you know, for the Fermi gas, you will have a box distribution for the fermions, which will soften up for higher temperatures, but this is similar then for non-zero temperatures, whereas for zero temperature you get a ground state that still has a jump, but no longer this full jump, but some reduced jump in a Fermi liquid, in a longer Fermi liquid. And one way to solve this, I mean, there are some one-dimensional cases where this can be solved analytically, and there's another numerical method that works well in high dimensions. And by high dimensions, I mean really taking the limit of lattice dimension to infinity, and then what you get is dynamical mean field theory. And in our case, we'll be looking at that for non-equilibrium. And it's a very well-established method for equilibrium. You can think of it in various ways. One way to think of it is of integrating out the lattice and being left with one single side. And this can be a good approximation in high dimensions. In low dimensions, it usually won't be. And what it means is you are left with your one single side and a host that represents the lattice of all other sides. And for it to represent this original lattice problem, the single side problem will have some hybridization function between the single side and this host that must be determined self-consistently so that it actually matches some properties of this lattice. And I won't go into the details here, but as I said, it's exact for the scaling limit of dimension to infinity, and that means that it's also a conserving approximation. There will not be any artifacts of this limit. It will be sort of all what must be positive will be positive, and so on. And the advantage is also, and this is useful for non-equilibrium problems in particular, there will be no lattice finite size effects. So you do this sort of in this thermodynamic limit, then you might have to discretize again these functions, but the original lattice size no longer enters and is taken to infinity. And for the non-equilibrium, it can be done in a similar way as planning it by these people. And then, of course, you have mean functions that will no longer be time transactionally invariant, but will depend on both times that occur in the definition. So this is just a method that will come back later, but now let me go through these three cases, or actually just integrable and non-integrable. So for an integrable case, I brought you also, so just so you know that it cannot only be done for Ising models, there's also a Hubbard chain where you can look at such a quench in the interaction, where you switch on the interaction from zero, so you start from a Fermi C, for example, in this case, to some finite value of the interaction. It can be done also for a Hubbard chain which has a long-range hopping that decays like 1 over r. This is a not so well-known model, maybe by Gebhardt and Wolkenstein from the 90s. So you start with a double occupation that is just 1/4 at half filling, and then it decays, and you can determine this long-time limit, and you can also determine the thermal a prediction from a really Gibbs ensemble, and that is wrong, of course, because there are constants of motion. In fact, you can map this onto a bosonic, onto three bosons, three hardcore bosons. It's sort of an analogon of the mapping of the Jordan-Wigner mapping, but here you go from fermions to three bosons. And here's some result, is where this tends to. For small coupling, you can calculate this, and it turns out this is wrong, but you can do the same thing with a generalized Gibbs ensemble, and then you recover not just this low U result, but the full result. So this is just...
And put in which charge in the...
Excuse me?
In the GG, which kind of charge are you putting on?
Well, you can, as I said, you can map this fermionic Hubbard model onto some free bosons, and they decouple. They are just sort of separate spaces. Yeah, right, they're occupation numbers. It's very analogous to the Ising case, just the...
There are no correlation between charges.
No. Well, there are, but not for the type of initial state that I have here. Otherwise, there could be in the spectrum, there might be, but not if you start from this sort of factorized initial state. That was the question.
And these are all analytic results?
Yeah, this is in fact analytic, yes.
There's no gain on G, so.
No, this is one dimension.
But if you have long-range shopping, you might argue the gain.
It's not, it doesn't have to do with the MFT. This is one dimension analytic. And just why does the GGE work here? We've heard already that there are criteria when it should work and when not from other people. Just let me give you criteria that we derived. If you consider now, suppose you have some integrable model, and for simplicity, these are just number operators that can be 0 or 1. It fits both the bosons and the hardcore bosons and the fermions. And suppose that in this integrable language, so this is the effective degree of freedom, that you have some observable that involves whatever, some number, some creation or annihilation of operators that correspond to these number operators, then in the generalized Gibbs ensemble for these guys, of course, you will get some factorization because each is independent. Whereas from the long-time limit, this long-time average, you know, you will get something that looks like this, and you can see that there must be some factorization going on in the ground state for these effective three degrees of freedom, and this can or cannot be then the same. Sometimes the system size will maybe help you, maybe the difference will go away for large systems, but here for the Hubbard chain, it's clear, you can look it up, and it turns out that in this effective language, the double occupation is just some quadratic term, and then this will always match, and that's why it always works. This is sort of from the early days when the question when a Gibbs ensemble works or not was not so, we didn't have so much experience. So this is sort of, you know this, but these sort of scenarios, let's now look at a non-integrable case, and this is now the MFT. So this is now an interaction quench, similar as before, starting from zero and going to, I didn't write this down, but so we start from zero and quench to a relatively small value of u equals 2. So the bandwidth is 4, and that's also the order of the critical u where metal insulator transition occurs, so we're still in the correlated metal phase. And what do you see here? You see this occupation number. Now in DMFT, K does occur, but everything depends in this case only on K through epsilon of K, the dispersion, and that's why it's plotted here as a function of epsilon. So here at time, here's the time, so at time equals zero, you see the step function, that's the Fermi C from which we start at time zero, and then the system evolves because we've switched on the Hubbard interaction, and what you see is that this momentum distribution gets smaller inside the Fermi surface and starts growing outside of the Fermi surface. And this is the jump that starts at one and then decays. And what you see here is a plateau. It sort of goes slow, pretty slow here. And this is precisely the pre-thermalization plateau that I mentioned before and that we've heard about and that was derived for precisely this kind of system by Stefan Kehr and Michael Möcke. And it is due, precisely, say in a moment again, due to this vicinity of an integrable point. You can also do the opposite thing. You can start from your Fermi surface, Fermi C, the free system, and now quench to a large value of U. And then the term with the double occupation, U times double occupation, is dominant, and as we know from the Greiner experiment and so on, you have the situation where you have U times an operator which is sort of dominating the Hamiltonian, and this operator is essentially an integer. And that means if you add 2 pi over U to your time, you are seeing this period, the wave function is almost periodic up to the effects of the other terms, and that's why you see these precise oscillations, and because of the other term, the hopping, it does decay on longer times. So that's also straightforward to understand in principle. And the pleasant thing is that if you quench now to some intermediate value of 3.3, which is just in the middle between these sort of scenarios, regimes where you have either pre-thermalization or these oscillations, and here you see that starting also from this step function, you at once go to a smooth distribution, and not only is it continuous, as you would expect for a thermal state, it's precisely the right thermal state. The temperature, of course, is determined from an equilibrium calculation. You know how much energy you put into the system from the initial state and the Hamiltonian, and you can do equilibrium calculation and plot these data, and they are precisely on top, and there are also further observables for which you find this sort of agreement. So, in fact, there is thermalization at this intermediate U, and it is fast in the sense that both this this longer quasi-stable state, either the pre-thermalized state or these oscillations, they both disappear more or less at one value. And I should also say, numerically, this can only be done until a certain time with this quantum Monte Carlo method with which this effective action is solved. So this is sort of lucky that the time scales where this thermalization is reached can be seen. In previous parameters here, you cannot continue this to see whether it actually thermalizes with this sort of solver.
Yeah. When you compare with thermal, you compare with thermal within the same DMFT, right?
Yeah. No, it's actually, this is an equilibrium DMFT calculation.
Okay, so it's equilibrium.
But it's the same Hamiltonian, it's completely the same thing.
Is there any other quantity you can calculate and see if that's also thermalizing
it? Yeah, in this longer paper, there are also comparisons for the Green function. So you can actually look at a two-time Green function and see that if you wait long enough, then the time, as a function of the time difference in this Green function, you also approach what you get in equilibrium.
And it's roughly the same time as the other variable?
Yeah, it's also fast. It's precisely here on this, actually at one point, at the two or something, it's essentially in this term.
Maybe I missed, is this still that same classical model, or is it high dimension?
Yeah, this is now, again, Hubbard model, but with a on a d-dimensional lattice, with d being large. This is sort of the exact solution for the infinite-dimensional Hubbard model, or an approximation to, say, the 50-dimensional Hubbard model.
Well, can you explain what happens at 3.2?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. Sorry, yeah, this is a longer answer.
Another question, similar but correct. I was also asked if the paternalization plateau is shrinking continuously approaching.
Yeah, I'll show you another picture in a second. But maybe I should do that now.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So dimension in the sense that, so of course the self energy doesn't depend on momentum, but the dimension, the actual structure of the Fermi surface doesn't actually.
Yeah, this is, I didn't have time to mention this, so the important thing is both in equilibrium and non-equilibrium DMFT, the self-energy is independent of momentum, but the green function depends on momentum through epsilon of k and through time or frequency of the self-energy. So that's why you get n of k or n of epsilon.
Okay.
Even though sigma is okay.
Right, but this whole process of convergence and so on, you don't actually care about details of the Fermi surface. I think that doesn't, like the shape of the Fermi surface and so on.
Yeah, in K space, this sort of course, for an infinite dimensional Brillouin zone, it's sort of hard to plot. So that's why you always just look at epsilon. Now, back to the question of this, how this. These oscillations go away, and what happens at 3.2, I mean, we extrapolated some things and put it at 3.2, this point where it crosses over. There are several approaches to these sort of dynamical phase transitions, just in the sense that something happens in the time behavior for branching across a certain value. And of course, Stefan gave a talk for one possible scenario, and I don't know if this is at work here. It might be. After hearing this, it will be interesting to actually evaluate this and see whether one can see the sort of effect from in the work distribution. I know that there's, and the problem is really that this U equals 3.2, this is no longer a weak or strong coupling regime. And so you need a non-perturbative method. And finally, interestingly enough, there is one. Sciro and Fabrizio have this Gutzwiller, time-dependent Gutzwiller approach that they apply to the system, and it has some artifacts. It doesn't really relax, it keeps oscillating, but there is one special value where it turns over, and if you plug in our numbers, they get 3.4. So this is like the Brinkman-Rice transition in the Gutzwiller approximation. It's very rough and not wrong, right in all the details, but it sort of gives you maybe a good explanation for this already, but it's still not so easy to see. I mean, in there you can maybe get a better understanding, but I don't have time to go into that. Let me just show you the data, because there's also this confirmation of the pre-thermalization picture. So this is a double occupation. It starts at 1/4 and then goes to some value, and this is also part of the pre-thermalization plateau as described by Stefan. You not only go to this value, this is in fact already the thermal value. So while the momentum distribution, this is the jump at the Fermi surface, it has this pre-thermalization plateau, and then later does this crossover. This is what you saw in the U equals 2 data, and this goes away here. While this still does something, it keeps redistributing the momentum occupation. The double occupation no longer changes. The black arrows are actually the thermal values from thermal calculations. So this means, as it's expressed in the pre-thermalization literature, the kinetic and the potential energy are already at their final values. But inside sort of the kinetic energy, there's still some redistribution going on.
In the upper curve, how does it reach the asymptote exponentially, algebraic?
You mean how this goes?
Let's say U equals 0.5, for instance.
Oh, does this little thing?
Yeah, how is it reached exponentially in time?
I don't know. I mean, this is quantum Monte Carlo data, so this is sort of, as you can see, that there's a little jitter. We didn't expect that. Actually, and did you expect, I mean, this will stay like this, but here the momentum distribution, it's sort of expected, just like here you see that this is very slow, but eventually this should also turn over and thermalize, but this is sort of a different topic. So the dashed lines are actually predictions from Merkel and Kerr-Ein, where we just plugged in our numbers for our system, and you see that they agree very well. Of course, they get a little worse when U is no longer small. I'll explain how you get to these dashed lines. Just for completeness, show you also here, these are the collapse and revival oscillations. If you go to a large view like U equals 8, you see this is here, over here, you get big oscillations, and you cannot, this is sort of a numerical method that is good for small U, so that's why the times that you can simulate here are limited. Numerical errors accumulate because you have, of course, a complex propagator and so on.
So where is the mod transition here? And what?
That is a good question. The mod transition in equilibrium would be at U equals 4.8 and at a temperature that is 0.05 and in these units. And I show you that you put much more energy in. So in that equilibrium phase diagram, you're at a temperature way above this mod transition, and you're at a U that is actually smaller than this mod transition. So it's not really clear how to relate that.
So if I look at this and I see a damped oscillation, the period of this oscillation, is there a simple scaling with U?
Yeah, this is the right scaling with U.
So is it a single oscillation?
Yeah, this is just this, as I said, this comes from as if you only had U in your Hamiltonian. U times an integer, and that means the period is 2 pi over U. And then maybe there's, yeah, that's it. And actually, these oscillations also have some sort of quasi-stable state or level. They go, have the middle of these oscillations is sort of here, and this is not the thermal expectation. So they have also some sort of quasi-stable value that they fluctuate around, and one can also understand that from perturbation theory, just for large coupling. And then also, if you come from above, as I said, it's sort of, it's not clear to me whether these oscillations go away and the pre-thermalization plateau here goes away at more or less the same U. Now, this can be a general situation, or it can just be that there's not enough room on the U axis, right? You either have this limit or that limit. But our finding is that they go away at the same U.
So here within DMFT, I mean, I guess you're not allowing for any magnetic order to
tell. Right. We start in a paramagnetic state, and then, of course, the Hamiltonian does not introduce it because it's also symmetric. You would have to start from a symmetry broken state if you were looking for that, but that's harder, of course, to do numerically. But an important thing, what I really would like to do, you in this part to take home, not only that this, we'll talk more about thermalization in a minute, but also that this is one of the systems where you can actually show numerically, because we're in the thermodynamic limit and doing a single side effective calculation, that a many body system in isolation can thermalize, and actually can do so rather quickly. And now let's continue. Yeah.
So you show a jump in the occupation number of the thermal surface. Do you know if a sharp step really survives at finite time? I mean, is there some kind of generalization of the Migdal theorem that tells you that it's really a drop, a jump? Or?
Well, I expect it to. I mean, if the system, I mean, here I know it thermalizes the whole momentum distribution. If the momentum distribution thermalizes, we expect that of a Fermi distribution for finite temperature because we've put energy in the system. So this should be continuous if you wait long enough and if the system.
Sure, no, but I mean, say the data for U equals 3 at time 1/2 or something.
Yeah, so no, this would still have a step.
And really, that's true mathematically, is it?
Well, for DMFT. I mean, one can understand that this happens in DMFT. But whether this is now robust enough to work in 2, 3, 4 dimensions, I don't know. I can prove. I have tried to prove.
Yeah, we've spent quite some time thinking about this when we worked on this originally, and I mean, my suspicion is it can also depend on the band structure. Like, say, if you start with a hypercubic lattice here, or you know, some it can depend on the tails of the kinetic energy in this limit. So we basically did not really dare to make a statement about that. So I'm not sure.
So since you mentioned Bell structure, this is for a density of states which is just a half circle. And so it has finite bandages. There are no complications from any tails. So now let's, because my title was pre-thermalization, let's spend a few minutes on the pre-thermalization. So as I said before, the situation is this. You have some free Hamiltonian. In our case, these are just the free fermions. And then you quench to this value. And in these seminal papers by Berges and, of course, with Kern, it's derived that if you have, so if G, you can think of it this way. If G is so small, the coupling strength, that the time scales 1 over g and 1 over g squared are well enough separated, then you can do perturbation theory and essentially take t to infinity because this is sufficiently large because g is small. So here's a formula. I mean, as Stefan, I must now recite what I've heard from you several times, so I hope I do it right. So the important thing is if you do perturbation theory, you shouldn't do it in the just in the Hamiltonian, because then you will also do it in time, and then of course you get so-called secular terms, which will just grow with time if you just expand e to the minus iht as 1 plus 1 minus iht. This will not be good for long times. So the idea is to do a unitary perturbation theory, which means you do a unitary transformation that's sort of takes care of the small interaction. Then you do the time evolution, and then you transform back. And in Merkle and Kern's work, this is done with flow equations. You can, and then you get this result. And you can also re-derive it sort of with sort of just one unitary transformation, not a continuous one. It always gives the same result. And it has some, you can also get at the time dependence. There's something that involves the initial state and the spectra that are involved. Those are in these functions. And if you, now the point is, you would have to continue this for order by order. But if G is sufficiently small, you can now take the long time average of this term, which will just give you 1/2. And then you get a value that is the starting value plus some correction. And this is what you see here. This is now the jump. These are again the time resolved data, and this is now this formula evaluated by us just for our system. And you see that not just the dashed lines that I had before, not just this final value if you formally take t equal to infinity here, but also the time dependence is pretty well described on intermediate times. Of course, then it goes wrong here somewhere because it's just 1 minus u squared. So it cannot capture this. But the pre-thermalization plateau works to describe this state.
Question to you, Dr. Stefan. So is it the same if I go to the basis of the final Hamiltonian, which is pretty sharp there? Okay, well, yeah. I go perturbatively to the basis.
That's what we did in this case, right?
So that's,
here it works. So it's right. And the advantage, if you do this, I'll show you one more slide. You have the advantage that you do this on the Hamiltonian level, right? You can also just get an effective Hamiltonian perturbatively.
Well, sometimes you might be away from integrability, even with teeny coupling, small as you like, but the term will break some fissure of the original model. Think, for instance, is in low temperature phase. There are two vacua. You have the magnetic field, no matter how tiny, you are breaking qualitatively the model. So what happened in this case?
Well, you don't
have G small, doesn't mean anything. What happens if I apply this formula?
I think you can still, I'm not sure, I'm sorry, here no symmetry is broken, and usually if the Hamiltonian breaks the symmetry, I guess you will get, it might still work, I don't know.
But one can get some zero and nominate for that.
No, because, if you do in the, I don't know this unity perturbation theory, but if you do say in the matrix element perturbation theory, you get infinity.
Yeah.
Well, let me just.
Yeah, let me talk to this too.
maybe some denominator gets zero, but notice that this denominator never is a problem because it's lifted by the numerator. So unless this diverges by itself, which could happen, I guess. I must say I haven't thought about it. So now, I want to make 2 points now. So what we've looked, this was a lot about non-integrable systems and really integrable systems. And before I mentioned these things about integrable systems. So one point is there's some similarity. In the integrable system, we relax to a non-thermal steady state. We all know this. Here, for the nearly integrable state, we relax to some pre-thermalization plateau. Are they actually related? And if so, we know we can describe this state by a generalized Gibbs ensemble. And the question that I want to answer is the pre-thermalization plateau also described by a GGE with approximate constants of motion, and what are they? And the first thing here is the following statement. You can view non-thermal states, steady states, in integrable systems as pre-thermalization plateaus that never decay. What does that mean? If you take this formula for the pre-thermalization plateau, this is again this 1 over R chain, I showed you this, and if you now just take the pre-thermalization plateau formula and apply it to the system, it gives you precisely the same thing at recoupling. So you see, in a way, an integrable system, and we have other examples also for strong coupling, but you cannot prove this in general, but there are examples where you can see the non-thermal steady state is in some sense described by this pre-thermalization scenario only. There's no further evolution because there are no further terms. You can sort of exactly map it onto a free system. So that's the one point. And the other is, yes, the pre-thermalization plateaus are described by a generalized Gibbs ensemble with approximate constants of motion. And now I'll rush by you the sort of the unitary perturbation theory. So you have some free system and you have some number basis, and the system starts in this ground state of H0, and then you switch this on. And the only important thing is that H1 really involves only these operators, otherwise the statistical theory, of course, cannot work if you couple to something else. And you can then, we call this psi naught tilde the interacting ground state, and you then do just a perturbation, canonical transformation order by order, similar to what's been done for the Hubbard model ages ago. And you fix your transformation, and you formally map your true Hamiltonian onto this sort of thing. There are some corrections that are just the ordinary perturbation theory formulas, and these are the approximate constants of motion that are no longer these number operators, but have a higher number of fermions added to it. They have a 4-fermion term added to it. And the generalized Gibbs ensemble is then this. And finally, if you go through the equations, you see that if you now calculate, it also depends now on your observable, as always. If you take the most interesting quantity in this setting, just this n of k in the full model, but now calculate this in the dressed Gibbs ensemble, you get precisely the expression for the pre-thermalization plateau. So you see that this plateau can be described by a generalized Gibbs ensemble, and that means physically that, in a sense, if this, of course, is small enough, like here it starts probably to break down, but if this has enough time to relax, then in some sense it relaxes to a statistical, or has the same properties as a statistical system that corresponds to this. So it relaxes as far as possible on this time scale. But of course, it cannot thermalize because it has these approximate constants of motion. If you have a general observable, suppose you have a more complicated situation, say this is a product of n of k's, then you get again some sort of factorization conditions similar to the one I showed you for the integrable system. So this is actually similar.
Can I just ask? Yeah. So went by a bit fast. So usually when you write down integrable systems, the conserved quantities are operators that are not really state. In other words, they're not projectors, they're just operators.
No, it's precisely the situation here.
So, but these guys are becoming more like projectors.
No, these are not projectors. These are like number operators. These are the things that occur just as usual in this Hamiltonian, you have epsilon alpha times some n alpha. If you have that, then you usually take the n alphas for your Gibbs ensemble, generalized Gibbs ensemble, right? Of course, it's not unique. We all know you can the conserved quantities, but these are not projectors. These are number operators.
So you're not generating any extra operators in your generalized Gibbs ensemble?
Yeah, this has extra operators. I didn't write it down. So this would be n alpha. I can just write down this. So what is I alpha tilde, or you might want to call it N alpha tilde? It's just the naked, which is just C delta C plus, and then there's some term beta gamma delta, and then you have some scattering term. This is what appears in your Hamiltonian. So this would be your, within the sum of that, this would be your H1. And then there's an energy denominator here. And then there's a 2 and some. So these are, in some sense, the number operators for the quasi-particles. Right? This is what this is.
And alpha tildes, do they commute?
Yeah.
Different than alpha?
Yeah.
I'm just confused.
It's a unitary transformation. The tilde is just a unitary transformation.
But these are not supposed to. So if you take a Hubbard model at half filling, sure, you can. This is how you derive the Heisenberg model, but.
No, it's low, a small coupling. Small coupling, not large coupling. So you just. What you can. If you can think of it this way, you have in the Hamiltonian C dega C from the free term, and then you have the four fermion term. And now you. If you put the right combination into your C's and you multiply them out, you will just get this value of U, this term with U. Right, so Well, I might have, but it turns out in this case I don't. I can't claim that I knew before whether I would have or not, but it turns out here, as you saw previously, a lot of the times there is just something in the numerator that will cancel anything, so there's no problem with taking the thermodynamic limit, and you can always, of course, if there are degeneracies, that might be a problem. So formally, I assume here that there are no, that these are sort of incommensurate, and this there's no problem. And for the Hubbard model, it works, but I can't say. I can prove this, but you can always think, this is like the degeneracies in the long time averages, and so we always assume for mathematical convenience that things are not commensurate, and you could always make this incommensurate by making a very rough boundary. But of course, I can't prove this. It turns out here it is not a problem.
I guess what I'm, in the end, wondering about is that you're constructing new quasi-particles. You're constructing quasi-particles in terms of elementary, in terms of cheap particles. But I would have thought that the lifetime of quasi-particles is not going to get any better if you can. In other words, when you do Fermi Winkler theory, you get some lifetime about a G squared or something like this. You can play this, the question is, by playing this game, are you constructing better, more stable excitations or not? And my feeling is that you shouldn't be able to. But maybe
it's a good question. I have a feeling what it is, but let me just say again, this is sort of formally correct, and it's on the Hamiltonian operator level. There's no lifetime here. This is just a new name for a certain operator, which turns out to represent the old Hamiltonian just fine. And then if you use it to do a statistical theory with it, it gives the same as before. And that's sort of the point. But it can also be used for something else. In particular, what is, of course, a nice picture to continue with this. I didn't have time to say anything about this. What happens here afterwards, we also know, of course, from Merkel and Kerr's papers, this should be described by a kinetic equation. And so now this should be, as we've heard, for the quasi-particles. So this is something that is not yet finished, so that to get also a good match with our numerical data from a kinetic equation, but it's sort of, it should be possible. We're working on it. So
the late time you're saying you have to take quasi-particle scattering into account to decay to cause the late time eventual thermalization.
Right.
Yeah.
That's essentially the question.
That's the picture. And I'm essentially done, so let me just conclude this part about the pre-thermalization. Stressed Gibson solvents predict pre-thermalization correctly, at least, for example, in these sort of small U-quenches. Also, integrable and nearly integrable systems are connected in the sense that non-thermal steady states and integrable systems are very analogous to pre-thermalization plateaus away from integrability, and they are connected by the sort of same Gibson solvent, because if you take the coupling smaller and smaller, the Gibson solvents, of course, also approach one another. And with that, I want to conclude and thank you for your attention.
I have a question. So these antennas, as you construct them this way, do you have any constraint or commutation relations? Do they commute or reject?
Exactly. Exactly. So there are sort of the creation and annihilation operators for this. They are sort of the naked plus G, and they are also made such that they anti-commute. And this is guaranteed because it's a canonical transformation, so it must be like that.
I actually cannot follow how you can use that to recover this Stefan's result that the expectation value of the number operator gets corrections to order two squared.
Well, what Stefan's result is for the expectation value of this. This is just some auxiliary thing. So what we really want to know is what the time evolution of this thing. So you have to plug this in, and then. But you can also do this. This program of transform, evolve, transform back. You can do also just with this sort of.
But I would have thought that you could recover those results by using this approach too.
Yeah, by this approach, but not in precisely this line. So you can see here. This line you can either get from Stefan's flow equations, or you can get it, but you see this is sort of n of k and nothing with tildes. The tildes are all eliminated, and then you just get this result. It's some calculation. You cannot see it just by looking at it like that. And also, I mean, I shouldn't bother you with it maybe, but just so you see this is sort of the proof. So you look at the GGE, and right, this is sort of in the tildes, and you do transform back, you get several terms. One is something you know, and then you have to look at some double commutator and use Wick's theorem because this is a product, and then you go use Wick's theorem backwards and so on, and in the end you get sort of the same thing. But it's also in the paper, I'm just saying. It's a few lines, but it's sort of all is well defined in this scenario. I mean, as Anatoly asked, I cannot prove that it should have worked, but it sort of turns out to work.
So in this kind of thinking, the amount in weak coupling, the amount of time it should take you to project these initial conserved quantities to the new conserved, approximate conserved quantities, that's some simple 1 over interaction?
Yeah, 1 over interaction squared is sort of, I think, the scale where this
interaction
is
squared.
This is also, of course, already in Stefan's work. So this, but I must say we didn't extract this from this data. So because here, I mean, you're no longer in the recoupling limit here. So we didn't have so many calculations. So here you cannot see it. Here you can see it in here, and so.
I thought you would be looking. Oh, I see. The initial time scale is
where it goes away or where it starts. Yeah, the initial time scale is sort of similar.
By dispersion.
But it's. I mean, this from these data you cannot really expect it.
In the cases in which this pre-thermalization scenario works, did you try to plot spectral statistics versus the integrability breaking parameter? you find that integrability breaks suddenly. There is a range in which you have the system that is still Poissonian.
Did you try? That's a very good question. Maybe it can be. I don't know if it can be done with this sort of simple-minded approach. Maybe
somewhere related to Giuseppe's question about the validity of perturbation theory around certain points. If it breaks immediately, I'm asking whether this perturbation scenario would still work in some different way or not. So I asked for this reason about.
If I think of other numerical studies, usually you know this starts Poissonian and then this sort of crossover, and this is probably, I mean, hopefully this or something similar can be expected here, I guess, but I don't know if
you
I
have access to that kind of information.
No, I don't know if I have access to it. I guess I should try. Sort of figure out where, yeah. But yeah, in this perturbative regime, I expect it to be probably, you know, a slightly deformed Poissonian, and that's probably what it would be. That's all you can hope for, I think. Otherwise, because we know that this down here in lots of quantities, this will no longer be described by the perturbation theory, because the orders are no longer separated. It's what's to be expected.
So. More questions? So let's maybe one more question. So maybe related to the last question, but so in this simple argument, this pre-summarization from to decays at time 1 over g square or something, is that
presumably, yes.
Consistent with numerical observation?
Or? Yeah, as I said, this is not enough to extract this. Yeah.
I mean, like, very primitively, it looks like bandwidth over u is the time, right? You know, if your bandwidth is 4, then it looks. Your Euclid 1 dies at 4, you know, and your Euclid 2 dies around 2 and so on, right? So
yeah, except that I don't know how good this, I mean, this is no longer, does not fulfill this. But yeah.
Yeah, no, it would have to be U squared because, I mean, for just for synergy reasons, it can't be.
It can't be, doesn't it?
Yeah, it would have to be U squared. But I think you really need to go to smaller values of U to see that.
Exactly. And then the problem is that this moves out very quickly, very far away, and then this would have to be done by a different method.
All right, so that's the Marcus. Thank you
for your endurance.